Accession number 29556, Mr. Brian Haskell Thomas, Reel 6. Now, the next thing then is, as you suggest, it's VE Day, May 8th, 1945, and the surrender of U-249 to the Magpie and Amethyst. I'm looking at some notes you made of the time. Now, what do you remember of that day?
Well, the 7th of May, we got a message from the Admiralty saying that the Germans' unconditional surrender would take place on the 8th, and that all U-boats were to surface, fly a black flag, jettison their ammunition, and report their position in clear language. In other words, no codes. And early on the 8th of May, we had a signal directed to the two ships, which is unusual, telling us of a U-boat off Land's End with an aircraft over it, British aircraft, and we were to go and pick it up and take it into Portland, which was then the Navy's anti-submarine school. And so we set sail for the position we'd been given, and about just before midday we sighted this U-boat on the surface. And so we put a boarding party on board, one officer, five ratings, one of whom was a signalman, one was a petty officer engineer. And the signalman had a lot of kit strapped to him, big radio, two big batteries, and just as he was about to step off the small boat from Magpie onto the U-boat, a wave thundered down between the two ships and started to surge away. And one of the Germans put his hands down and pulled this chap straight out of the water. So he had a very amenable view of the Germans ever since. Now, when we get on this U-boat with two tins of corned beef, two loaves of bread and a bottle of rum, they got on the U-boat, have sausages, cheese, pâté, wine. And within 10 minutes, there's only one subject of conversation between the two crews. How much do you get paid?
And how did you get on? Did you go aboard the
ship?
No,
I was off to the watch on the Magpie. We stayed alert throughout the night with all our guns trained on the U-boat. And the officer our officer on the U-boat asked what should happen if they try to interfere with the operation. We will open fire, was the message. But what we did to stop them submerging, we secured an anchor chain outside the deck of the ship and then dropped it down the conning tower so they couldn't submerge. But they were all right. I mean, they were as happy as most of us. No more of this thundering about and killing of each other. And then there was some PR, or spin doctoring, when we got there. A very officious commander, R.N. Cainborn, said to our crew, you have to get off now. We're going to put the poles on to take it in. Because the poles had had a rough time during the war. And they thought that was a significant one. And the officer also said, you are not to take any of these souvenirs the German sailors have given you with you. You know, we'd be given... They've been given Zeiss binoculars and things like that. And so that was it. The interesting thing about having Amethyst with us, you probably recall Amethyst was stuck up the Yangtze for some weeks. When they decided to make a film of that incident, Amethyst had been broken up, but Magpie was still operating. So all the pictures you see of the Amethyst in this film that they made is actually Magpie. So a bit of memorabilia.
And that was recorded quite a bit afterwards.
I
don't think many people know that.
No.
Now, so what happened after? So you were back at Portland Harbour then with this U-boat.
Yeah.
What happened then?
Then we were told to prepare to go to the Pacific. And so we did whatever we need to do for stores and equipment. And, of course, including tropical kit for the right reason this time, and set sail for the Pacific. We were interfered with in Gibraltar, a Liberty ship coming alongside the jetty ahead of us, grossly misjudged what he was doing and struck us amidship. So that delayed us while we had a few plates to be repaired. And by the time we got to Malta, the bomb had been dropped and it was VJ Day.
That's August.
Yeah. And then we were sent
How
on...
How did you react to VJ Day? I mean, because you must have... Or were you worried about going out fighting the Far East? Or what did you think? When
very worried. Very worried. Because we'd seen all the newsreels.
So, was there celebrations on VJ Day on the ship? Or was it not possible at sea?
I think we played a water polo match with some local Maltese sailors. Very, very interesting tactics. They'd stand on your shoulders and push with their feet and you go down for miles. But that's just a story. And then we went to the other end, the far end of the Med, and were put on this program of controlling the flow of Jews into Palestine. There were so many, hundreds of thousands of them, but the infrastructure just couldn't handle it all at once. And I can understand them not appreciating this. The drill was to take them to Cyprus to a holding unit and then allow them to go.
Now, what do you remember of those operations? That was in late 45.
Well, the...
How did it all work?
Patrolling ships, of which Magpie was one, had to go out every night to try and find these emigrant ships creeping in. They'd darken the ship, have no lights, and the Jews had got wind of what was going on, so they lay flat on their stomachs on the deck, and every time a sailor from a boarding party stuck his head above the gunwale, there was a thump, ow, and a splash. But we managed to get over that eventually, but it was a long task, and we really hated it.
What happened when you found a ship?
Well, we'd had to take it back to Cyprus, and that was quite a problem. Sometimes they refused to operate the engines, so we'd have to tow it. And then when we were having
what
a rest...
What state were the refugees in?
Oh, pretty poor, pretty poor. Didn't have much in the way of clothes, or emaciated. But, you know, just desperate to get to the promised land. You're going to sympathise with them wholly. It's almost worse than sinking U-boats.
And what about this? Was there a threat from the Palestinians at all?
You
mentioned limpet mines.
Yes. They used to creep out at night and stick limpet mines under the hulls of the ships. We were based in Haifa Harbour. And also where we were landing the ships when the crews were allowed to go ashore for a stroll from time to time, the jetty, they'd put railway lines in the seabed pointing down to a certain depth. They put those in at high tide and the ships would go alongside and then the water would drop, not very much because it was the Mediterranean, but when the boat was filled with sailors it would sink lower in the water. These railway lines would come out through the bottom of the boat. So they were very keen to disturb the whole operation, and you can understand it.
Anything you particularly remember about that period?
Yes. When we were in Beirut, I was sent to Damascus to the embassy. I can't remember what for now. Some secret papers I had to get or deliver. I can't remember. They'd had a clapped out car with a clapped out Arab. And he drove like a man possessed through these mountain ranges. I said to him, "Why do you drive so fast?" He said, "People up there roll boulders down on cars." Anyway, eventually got my job done at the embassy and they took me out to lunch and I noticed the restaurant table was all made of steel. I said to the manager, "Why steel?" He said, "Periodically people fling the doors open, spray the inside of our restaurant with machine gun bullets, then run off. And the drill is to upend the table and crouch behind it." I mean, how can you live in that society? Especially in a country where everybody has a Kalashnikov in the wardrobe, although it had been a Lee Enfield in those days. but I got back eventually. And then we were sent to various Italian ports up the Adriatic to try and give the crew a bit of rest, because we've been on the go for quite a number of months. We're sea nearly all the time.
And what do you remember of that?
Well, we went into Bari briefly, but the day before we arrived, an ammunition ship had blown up in the harbour and sunk 20 other ships in the process. So all you could see was a sea of masts sticking out of the water. That's quite something. And then we went to Trieste. Well, I was very impressed with that city. Also impressed with the US bombing. Not a bomb landed outside the dockyard, which is quite something. And then we gave half the crew a few days at a rest camp which had been set up in Klagenfurt. And then the other half had a couple of days there. And then we came back down to continue the patrols that we were doing for the Palestinian situation.
Back to the Palestinian.
Yeah.
Any other incidents during those patrols?
Nothing particular. There were some very, very determined people on the German ships. But we managed to, you know, do it. Nobody was hurt. One or two sailors were knocked into the sea, but we got them out again. But that was it.
Then what?
And then I think, what's it, February?
Looks like February, yeah.
February 46.
I
left the Magpie.
Was the ship decommissioning?
No.
You left it?
Yeah, she left it. And then
why did you leave it?
Well, I was getting near my DMOB number. And they were keen to get back to the normal naval routine with the regular Navy there.
How did you feel about leaving the ship?
Oh, very sad. Nearly 2.5 years. And the whole thing worked very well. Crew got on well together. We only had one chap late back from leave in Liverpool, half an hour.
Did you have a party or anything when you left, or any celebration? Or
not really, because there's, like when I took over the job on Magpie from the regular RN warrant officer, I had half a day's handover, and this is all the chap who came to take over from me had.
Now, what did you do then? What you know, your last bit? Because
I went to become senior officer of a Hunt class destroyer, Melbrake, in Chatham.
Melbrake.
Melbrake.
M-E-L-B-R-E-A-K.
Yeah. Hunt class destroyer at like Cottesmore. And was senior officer of that ship until.
What do you mean by senior officer?
In charge of it. We didn't go anywhere, but it had a crew, who all of whom were waiting for DMOB.
So you as senior, you weren't captain, but you were just acting as senior officer.
That's right, yeah.
Of the men who were aboard it.
Yeah. And the ship was basically supposed to be in reserve, but you know, we could have been required if something else had blown up.
Was she part of the reserve fleet then?
It was, yes. Had been.
What did the job entail? What do you remember? Do you remember anything about it?
The main thing, making sure the sailors wore their uniform went ashore. They were a bit bulky. Lots of them wanted to get home. You can understand that. And we had to do the care and maintenance on the ship.
And you were there from what? It looks like April 46. You must have had a bit of leave after you left the Magpie or something like that. You were there from April to May aboard the Melbrake.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
And what about your demobilisation was July 46. What do you remember of the demob?
The awful suits.
What was awful about it?
Green and very, very rough material. Well, of course, let's face it, they weren't manufacturing many clothes during the war, except uniforms. And we just had to go into a sort of civilian mode by having a set of civilian clothes.
Now, what were you going to do then? You know, do you see what I mean? Your time's come to an end.
Yeah.
But you've been in the Navy a good long time by then.
That's right.
What were you going to do about your career? Or I mean, because you hadn't had any sort of a career before.
No, that's right. Absolutely.
There was no job open for
no.
you.
No.
So what were you?
Well, I got a temporary job in an insurance company briefly.
Now, how did you get that? Did you get it for yourself, or did the Navy find it?
No, the Navy didn't find anything.
And what did that entail? We'll just get you back into civilian life, you see.
Well, I was on the admin side of the Atlas Insurance Company, which was very old, and some of the managers were also very old.
So it was just office work?
Yeah, And then I decided I wanted something better than that, and joined Shell in 1948.
What as?
Well, just a clerk.
A clerk.
And then I became a chartered shipbroker through evening classes. And I started in the tanker side. We were busy chartering tankers because we had to build up the fleet after the losses during the war. And then I went into the supply and distribution, programming the tankers and so on. And eventually ended up in the Singapore on the supply side, buying the crude oil and selling the products all over the Far East.
So that was your career, and a very successful career. Now, what do you think effects your war service had had? Good, bad, mental, physical?
Oh, very good, very good.
In what way?
Well, produced enabled you to think, analyze problems, make decisions. Because one of the things of being in the Navy, you get man management very, very early. And that stood in good stead.
What about physical effects? Any physical, anything that untoward?
No, nothing.
So it was good for you?
Now, oh, yes.
What about your contacts with your old comrades? Tell us about you, because you're a member of, is it the HMS Magpie Association, or is it the Second Escort Group?
Both. We had a Magpie Association, and also we were a member of Captain Walker's Old Boys Association, QUBBA.
That's what it's known as, is it?
Yeah, which had a reunion in Liverpool for 40 years until 2004, when we decided there weren't enough of us anymore. But we were very well known in the town.
And what would you do with... well, let's look at the Magpie first. What did that association organise or do?
Well, we had an annual jolly in Southport, which coincided with the annual jolly in Liverpool. We used to go up to Southport and have our reunion dinner in a hotel there on the Saturday night. And then we'd go down to Liverpool on the Saturday, to dinner in the Bootle Town Hall with the rest of the group.
That would be the Captain Walker's Old Boys.
That's right, yes. And then we'd have a service at the Bootle War Memorial. And on the Sunday, we would take part in the annual Battle Atlantic service in Cathedral. And then march through the streets.
Now, are either of those associations going still at all, or...?
Not really. We had our last Captain Walker's reunion in 2004 and decided that, really, we didn't have enough to keep it going. And sadly, a year later, the lottery offered to pay for us to have 2 days in Liverpool. And we got about, 34 chaps and their wives, and that was quite good in the Adelphi, although that wasn't the hotel it used to be. Three of my sailors had their wallets stolen within hours. And of course, I was surprised, the whole of the reception area was open to the outside, and of course they had all the papers they bought for the residents standing there, and people coming off the street, take a paper, walk out. But that's the way of the world these days. We did collect £50,000 and put up a statue to Walker on the pierhead at Liverpool.
Oh, it's you who did that, your association?
Yes. And Newfoundlandborough came and unveiled it. And Captain Walker's son was there, whose grandson, I beg your pardon, who's a retired Rear Admiral now. Strange. And his grandson was a nuclear submarine captain, which is rather odd when you think of it. His dad went around sinking them and he went around driving them. Patrick Walker, spitting image of his dad. We said, every time we saw him, he said, "Oh, the bus is back." And he was a really very charismatic fellow. And we had a lot of incidents. We were able to fly out to Hong Kong to visit the ship that was called Starling, a new ship. And we had a visit to his nuclear submarine. And every time we had our reunion, the May weekend in Liverpool, they sent a ship up. And of course, we were there for several of the reviews of the fleet. 1993, we had a big review of the fleet out off Anglesey, and the weather was horrendous. And we were quite pleased because all the newspaper correspondents were in a ferry which had been thrown back by the clapper. But there were some small naval crafts which had to go back. But it's quite distinctive because those ships were all grey except one US Coast Guard vessel, which was white, and a big shell tanker, which is painted red. So it's quite an exhilarating thing. And we had John Major and Ludovic Kennedy and people like that.
So it's obviously very, the associations were obviously very important.
Oh, yes, yes, because it all started by one of the engineers on Starling. We all spotted a note in the paper to say that the Starling was going to be scrapped. And we tried to buy it, but we couldn't raise enough money. You had to put it in the museum. And we started the reunion. And we had a lot of help from the R&R in Liverpool, HMS Egret. And
what was it like meeting your old men? I mean, did you recognise?
Yeah. Some very, very good.
Thank you very much.